Hey, how's it going, my friend? This is James Randhouse, founder of PCI Institute. And in today's webinar, we're going to be talking about what is neurolinguistic programming. Now, just to give you a little bit of information about myself, now I actually became a certified NLP practitioner back in August of 2015. So it's been a little bit over 2 years now that I've been very active in the field of neurolinguistic programming. I'm the type of person where once I get like really interested in something, like I want to read like every book about it. I want to see like who are the experts, who are the leading people within that field and stuff. So I feel confident saying that by the time you finish watching this entire webinar on what neurolinguistic programming is, you should have a very clear idea of what it's about and why it's and all the different components that makes it up. Because if you're just kind of like on the outside looking in, if you're not too familiar with what NLP is about, you probably heard about like different techniques, or maybe you've heard of like things like phobia curves and stuff like that. And there's really is a lot of different pieces when it comes to like understanding neurolinguistic programming. So we're going to take it step by step and really just come to have a very full understanding of what NLP is about. So if you're the type of person that learns best by like writing down and taking down notes and stuff, I definitely recommend grabbing just a sheet of paper and a pen and just to write a couple of notes on, because we're going to go over a lot of information. So with that being said, let's get started. So neurolinguistic programming, also known as NLP, is pretty much made up of three distinct words coming together. We have the word neuro, which pretty much refers to how we process experiences through our five senses being visual, auditory, kinesthetic, olfactory, gustatory, and language as well. Now we're going to dive a little bit more into the different representation system later, but that's pretty much what falls under the category of neuro. Linguistics obviously is what refers to like language and nonverbal system. This also includes things such as math, music, and art. And programming is pretty much just the act of creating systematic responses, also known as habits. Now, if you're into like computers, then you're probably familiar with the idea of like computer programming. How like if it wasn't for computer programming, you probably wouldn't even be watching this right now. So through the power of programming, through our neurolinguistics, we're able to grow and create massive change of people in just a very limited amount of time, just by affecting the mind, the body, the neurology, and so on and so forth. So now Richard Bandler, one of the co-founders of neurolinguistic programming, has been said that NLP is an attitude backed by a methodology that leaves behind a trail of techniques. Now, most people, when they think of neurolinguistic programming, they usually think about like the different techniques that's evolved in itself. But really, if you really want to understand neurolinguistic programming, or if you want to be someone that's actually successful in using neurolinguistic programming, then we really got to start with the attitude, because really the attitude is where it all starts. Now, before we jump into that, I just want to talk about a little bit more about the founders of neurolinguistic programming. It's these two gentlemen right here, Mr. Richard Bandler and John Grinder. Now, just an interesting fact, Richard Bandler and John Grinder actually had met in the University of California over at Santa Cruz. And they these were the original three people that they had modeled prior to them forming neurolinguistic programming. The three people that they modeled were Virginia Satir, who was a world-renowned family therapist, Fritz Perls, who is the father of Gestalt therapy, and Milton Erickson, who was considered the father of modern hypnotherapy. So it was these three people that they had went to model that allowed them to uncover the patterns and the structures of excellence, so to speak, to enable them to create such amazing changes within people. Now, it's thanks to their modeling that they was able to come out with their first book, which is known as The Structure of Magic. The Structure of Magic was originally published in 1975, it's here in The Structure of Magic where the meta model was officially formulated for understanding the structure of language. Now, this book was intended to be used primarily by therapists for the clients, because as you can see in a previous slide, the three people that the founders have modeled were all like therapists in some sense of the word. But it ended up becoming a lot more popular outside of the field of therapy. Like, people were picking up this book and were able to get like great changes just from like applying the concepts within this book. Now, if you haven't read this book, I definitely recommend picking it up. You could probably find it on Amazon or something like that. But this is just to give you a little bit of history on what NLP is about. And one of the best places to start is definitely with the literature. Now, L. Michael Hall, he's also an NLP master trainer as well. He came in the game much later than Richard Bandler and John Grinner, of course. But this is what he says in regards to Richard Bandler. He says, "To know Richard Bandler makes one aware that he served many years as a creative genius behind NLP. To get to know him beyond that rough exterior, introduces one to his spirit of passion and going for it, and his curiosity for the possible. And this very spirit functions in a foundational way to make NLP dramatic and dynamic. Now, maybe you might have never thought of NLP being something that's dramatic and dynamic, but it is in practically every sense of the word. I mean, if you really want to go and you want to create changes, if you want to live a life that's just something you can just wake up to and just kind of click your heels in the morning, then you want to be able to have that type of flexibility that NLP offers, where you're just able to be able to change your state, be able to run your own brain, so to speak. Because there's a lot of people in this world where they kind of just wake up in the morning and they're not really running their own brain. They're just running programs that they just kind of like go on autopilot. You know, they wake up, they go to work, they come home, and they just kind of do the same thing day after day. Now, NLP, it offers something a lot more richer, offers a much more richer lifestyle. So maybe this may or may not be for you, but if you're looking to live a much more dramatic and dynamic lifestyle, not dramatic in the bad sense, of course, then you probably want to look into neurolinguistic programming. Now, let's talk about this NLP attitude, because that was the first thing that that Richard Bandler had mentioned when he was talking about NLP. So first thing when it comes to NLP attitude is that you want to be purposive. You want to act from intention. And pretty much what that means is that you don't want to be performing any actions that doesn't have any thought behind in itself. Like, you want to be clear in what it is that you're doing. Secondly, it says professionalism gets results. You see, I mean, you can never really go wrong with being a professional, especially when it comes to like dealing with people and stuff. You always want to convey that level of just being able to hold yourself upright. Like, you don't want people to think of you of any less as being a professional person. Thirdly, you want to wed competence and confidence. Now, we're jumping a little bit ahead here. We're going to talk a little bit more about competence and confidence later when we start talking about the elements of attitude. But for the purposes of this slide here, pretty much just to be competent in something means just to be able to possess a degree of skill, like a degree of proficiency in something. And confidence is really just a belief in yourself that you have these skills. So as you gain more competence, then logically you want to also be gaining a proportionate amount of confidence as well, which is why I say that you want to wear competence and confidence together. As you become more competent, you want to become more confident. They just build off of each other. Next is flexibility, to be outrageous or crazy. Just like how L. Michael Hall was saying that Richard Bandler helps to make NLP very dramatic and dynamic, flexibility really plays a huge role in that. Like, you want to be able to vary your responses in order to get the things that you want. Or let's say if you're trying to work with a client, you want to be able to vary your responses to the point where, like, you can help that create and actually create that change. You don't want to ever, like, get locked up in a box or just get locked into one way of doing things. Which kind of brings us to our next point, which is experiment, which is pretty much just to try new things. I mean, this world is so big yet so small at the same time. We're probably only going to understand probably just a small part of it, and then we're going to die. So you really want to go out there, and you want to just kind of keep on trying new things and stuff. You want to see, like, what's out there. What is it that you can do? What is it you like? What is it you don't like? Which also builds on the next point, which is to view life as a challenge. You want to view it as something that can be overcome. Like, you have to already believe that you have the skills and the capability to go out there and get what you want. And even if you don't necessarily have those skills yet, you know that you have the capability to go out and to develop those skills. And you just have to attack life like it's a challenge, like something that you can actually win. And also, last but not least, like, you want to use some common sense. You know, you want to take calculated risks, guys. Like, obviously NLP is a great field, and it could allow you to do things that you wouldn't normally be able to do, such as creating rapid change at such small amounts of time. But common sense is always going to play a role in anything that we do in our lives. You don't want to do anything that could really, like, seriously damage you, or something that could lead to, like, irreversible results. Next, you want to stay fascinated and curious. Like I said before, I mean, the world is so great and big out there. There's no reason to ever think that you know all there is to know. Like, you always want to keep on going out there to learn more, which comes with asking how, keeping that wide eye factor, and just having awe and radical amazement. Now, I know these sound like some pretty heavy words we're throwing out there, but I'm telling you that just by adopting this kind of a mindset, so to speak, this is what's going to allow you to live a much more richer, fulfilling life. And last but not least, you want to always act from integrity. Like, we all know, I mean, if we all growing up in, like, somewhat of a decent household, then we all know, like, what is the right thing to do, like, on some level. So you always want to act from that level, and even if you're wrong, you want to be able to admit that you're wrong and be able to adjust accordingly. Now, you might have thought we was done with attitude after we just gone over those things, but we're going to dig even deeper into attitude and start talking about the elements. So first, we're going to go over the 12 C's of attitude. Now, the first C in attitude is congruency. And congruency pretty much means when your words and actions correspond with one another. Now, with NLP, NLP is just as much as something you think about as it is as something that you do. So when your words... Now, obviously, we have the words neurolinguistics, which refers to the body and also to language as well. So you want to ensure that your words and your language, I mean, like the things that you say and the things that you do correspond with one another. This is what's going to help you create change, not only within yourself, but also within other people as well. Now, competence is also something that we had touched on a little bit earlier. Competence is pretty much just nothing more than possessing a certain amount of skill in something. Now, when it comes to neurolinguistic programming, there's different techniques that you're going to be learning about. So you're going to want to develop a certain level of competence in order to be able to utilize these techniques effectively. And confidence is something you also touched on a little bit earlier as well, which is just pretty much the belief in the effectiveness of one's own ability. So like we were saying before, you want to write competence and confidence together, but both of these things stand well on by themselves, but they also work very well together. So as you're developing your skills and you're becoming more well-versed in neurolinguistic programming, you should also become more confident as well, which is going to help you become a lot more effective in utilizing it and in sharing it with other people. Next is creativity, which is kind of funny because creativity is the C in PCI. So creativity is just pretty much the ability to create meaningful new forms. Now, something I just want to mention here that I might mention a little bit later is that neurolinguistic programming does not end with Richard Bandler and John Grinder. Now, Richard Bandler and John Grinder granted all the people that created neurolinguistic programming, so we already owe them a huge debt, but they're not where neurolinguistic programming starts. Anybody can come into this field and help further advance this field, whether it's discovering new patterns and new ideas that complement the old ideas. I mean, that's pretty much what this field is about. It's a very alive field, and there's plenty of room to come in here and to make your mark, so to speak. So make sure you exercise those creative muscles. Next, we're going to talk about concern. Now, the way I use concern is pretty much the regard for or interest in someone or something. Now, at the very least, I hope you have some level of concern for a neurolinguistic program. Is this something you're interested in? But especially when it comes to working with clients, you also want to have a degree of concern as well. Because obviously, we're here to help people if you're using neurolinguistic programming in that sense. So you want to make sure that you actually have a certain level of concern for the people that you work with. And you want to see them help, like, overcome whatever problems or limitations or blockages that they may have. Next is care. Now, care is close attention, as in doing something well or avoiding harm. And this is very, very similar to the word concern, but care kind of is a little bit different in that sense, because you also want to care about the people that you're working with. You want to care about the type of work that you're doing. And you also want to avoid hurting people as well. So concern and care are very similar to each other in that respect. Next is commitment. Now, you want to be committed, not only, like, if you want to be in a neurolinguistic program, you want to be successful in this, you want to be committed to actually learning all that you can about it, and as well as, like, being committed to the people that you're working with when you're utilizing this technology. Now, commitment, the formal definition of commitment is the state of being emotionally or intellectually devoted to a belief, a course of action, or another person. So this definitely falls in line with neurolinguistic programming, especially if you're the type of person that wants to go out and you want to help people, or if you're very committed to the ideas of neurolinguistic programming and how it can help people. Both commitment plays a huge role in both of those respects. Next is curiosity. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but we're going to touch on a little bit more again. Curiosity is just nothing more than the desire to know or to learn. So when it comes to neurolinguistic programming, there's a lot to know, and you're going to see that much more as we go through the different slides and stuff. But you always want to maintain that certain level of curiosity. Like, when we were kids, we were just naturally curious. Like, we just wanted to learn everything and anything there was to know. So as a neurolinguistic programmer, if you could just find a way to find, like, that curiosity that you had as a kid and just kind of bring it to bear on everything that you do, like, just keep it with you always, because it's always going to help you learn more, do more, and become more. Next, when it comes to attitude, we're going to talk about choice. Choice is the opportunity or the power of choosing. Now, one of the big things in neurolinguistic programming is that we're always trying to increase choice for other people. We're going to touch on this a little bit more later, but since choice is one of the elements of attitude, we're going to talk about it now. People It's always better to have more choice than less choice, and it's always better to have choice over no choice. Like, we never want to take away choice from other people. We never want to take away choice from ourselves. We just want to empower people to have more choices, and hopefully those choices that we empower them to have will lead them to better outcomes than they're currently creating at the moment. So always want to create more choice for people. Next is challenge. Now, we touched on this a little bit before, but challenge is really the test of one's abilities or resources in a demanding but stimulating undertaking. Yes, that's a dictionary definition. But anyways, challenge, you always want to keep like challenging yourself. That's just a great attitude to have in general, even if it's not. Like, for me, like, I used to play sports when I was a kid. Like, I used to play handball. I did weightlifting. Like, I always like to push myself. And when I found out about neurolinguistic programming, and I realized that, and I just realized how wide and diverse the field was, I kind of looked at it as a challenge, like something that I could really just go out there and really just apply myself towards. So I definitely encourage you, like, if you've never really been the type of person to exercise the challenge within you, then definitely use it when it comes to neurolinguistic programming, because there's always going to be more to learn. You always want to keep challenging yourself and just keep growing yourself, because that's what's going to help you become much better and much more proficient. Next is clarity. Now, clarity is defined as the clearness of thought or style. Now, clarity is very important, especially when it comes to like forming like a well-formed outcome, which is an idea we'll be discussing a little bit later. But you always want to be clear on what it is that you want to do. Like, if you're helping someone, you want to be clear on what it is that the problem that they have, what it is that you're going to do to help them solve those problems. Clarity is just something that's always going to be very useful for you to have. And next is consequences, because consequences is defined as something that not logically or naturally follows from an action or condition. So when it comes to anything that we do, there's always going to be consequences. Like, if you decide to not go to work, there's going to be consequences. If you decide to not pay your bills, there's going to be consequences. If you decide to not solve a problem that you've been having, there's going to be consequences. So we always got to be aware of the consequences behind the actions, behind the things that we do, and also behind the things that we don't do. Now, next, after the 12 C's, now we're going to go over the 12 E's of attitude. I know, a lot of letters, a lot of stuff, isn't it? But anyways, the 12 E's. Next, we're going to talk about excellence. Now, excellence is the state or quality of excelling or being exceptionally good. Now, excellence is very different from perfection. Now, I'm not asking people to be perfect here, but everybody has the capability of excelling in anything. It could be in neurolinguistic programming. It could be in sports. It can be in school. It could be whatever. Like, you want to be exceptionally good at something in your life. And if neurolinguistic programming is something that you're interested in, then having an attitude of just excelling in it is not only going to be good for you, but it's also going to be good for the people that you decide to work with, if you decide to take NLP to a therapeutic setting, so to speak. Next is excitement. Now, excitement is a feeling of lively and cheerful joy. Now, don't you just love feeling excited? Like, imagine if you had won the lottery or something like that. Like, you would just be probably bouncing over your seats. Now, granted, winning the lottery is pretty unlikely for most people, but just having excitement, just being happy about being alive, just work with people, like, that excitement, like, it's contagious, and people like to be around people that are just full of good vibes and positive energy. Next is envision. A vision is to have a picture. It's a picture in the mind, essentially. Now, picturing in the mind is going to definitely come to the place. But if you start talking more about like different about representations and stuff like that, we touched a little bit on it earlier. But you want to be able to have a clear picture in your mind whenever it comes to like doing something. Like, if you want to help somebody, you want to be able to form a clear picture. Or when you're using like the different techniques, let's say if it says to remember a time where you felt really successful, you want to be able to clearly picture in mind like what that time was like for you. Like, being able to vision is just going to come in great handy. And a lot of the most successful athletes use it, like prior to them competing or something like that, like, they'll just stop for a minute and they'll just envision in their mind the result that they want, and then just go out and execute. Now, after envision is energized. And energized is to have or cause to have energy. So It kind of goes hand in hand with the whole excitement thing. Like you wanna be giving like energy to other people, and you wanna be energizing yourself. And the way you energize yourself is by putting yourself into the right state to energize other people. This is also something that can be very useful when it comes to like helping yourself, helping other people. So have some energy. If you don't, like be able to, like, get up on your feet, you know, go work out. Working out is really great for like energizing yourself, you know what I mean? Eating good food, you know what I mean? Laughing, just have some high positive energy. That's what it's about, guys. Next is to enable. Now, enable is to make possible. Now, as an NLPer, we're able to enable people to create the changes that they want to create. Now, granted, like, people ultimately, it's them that decide that they want to create the change, but we enable that to happen. Why? Through our knowledge, through our understanding, through understanding the different patterns. That's how we're able to enable others to create the changes that they want in life. And next is ecology. Now, ecology is the dynamic balance of any elements in the system and a concern for the overall relationship between a being and its environment. Now, ecology is also something that's very important in the field of NLP, because when we want to go in, we want to create like changes within people. We always talk about like doing an ecology check, where pretty much we want the change that the person creates not only to be good for them, but also to be good for the people around them, to be good for their environment. You never want to create a change that ends up being detrimental to that person, or in the long run becomes detrimental to the people around them. It's always want to be good for them and good for everything around them. Next is to entertain. Now, the entertain is to hold, excuse me, to hold the attention of pleasantly or agreeably. So, I mean, NLP is a very like it's kind of fun in a sense, because you get to, like I said, you get to be flexible, you get to be like kind of out there, so to speak, and stuff. And when you're working with people, you want to have like kind of like that lightheartedness when it comes to like work with other people and stuff. Like, you don't want to be like overly serious and stuff, unless of course like you deal with an overly serious person, then you want to kind of match or marry them in that aspect. But you want to be able to hold people's attention, show them that that you can be engaging and stuff, because we like to engage with other people that are engaging in. This will definitely come in handy when it comes to using NLP on other people and helping them create the changes that they want. Now, next is enlightenment. Now, enlightenment is the action of enlightening or the state of being enlightening. And I think both of those parts are very important, especially for the purposes of NLP. Now, the action of enlightening, like, with NLP, you can really help bring to light to some people that are like in the dark about their beliefs and about their limitations. So, like, we as NLP practitioners, we can help shine the light on other people and show people where it is that they've been stuck at, and help them get unstuck and start living the life that they want. And if you're someone that's serious about helping other people, then you should be just as serious about helping yourself. So, through utilizing these different patterns of self on yourself, you're able to align yourself and be in a point where you can truly go out there and truly exercise your skills and capabilities, because now you're in a state of enlightenment and now you can go and help enlighten other people. Next is expectation. Expectation is a strong belief that something will happen. Now, expectation really falls in line with the idea of having a well-formed outcome, especially when it comes to NLP. Like, you want to be clear about what it is that you want, about what it is that you're looking for. And a lot of people, they really don't get anywhere worthwhile in life is because they're not clear about what it is that they're expecting to happen. Like, if you're just expecting anything to happen, then that's exactly what's going to happen. Or if you're not expecting anything to happen, then maybe nothing will happen, or maybe something you don't want to happen will happen. So you want to be clear about what it is that what you're expecting to happen. Next is to experiment. Now, experiment is something we touched on a little bit earlier. The experiment is nothing more than just to try out new concepts or ways of doing things. Now, if you're watching this right now, then maybe you're probably interested in experimenting and trying out new things, especially if you're not familiar with NLP at all, because it was very different to me. Like, I had never learned anything that really fell in line with the whole NLP model. But as I started experimenting with the model more, I began to realize the power that it had in as far as like helping me and also helping me to help other people. Next is ecstasy. Now, ecstasy is an overwhelming feeling of great happiness or joyful excitement. Now, I know now for some of you that might sound a little bit extreme, but hey, I mean, we're talking about NLP here. If you wanna Excuse me. If you want to create great changes, sometimes you got to be like a little bit extreme. You got to be a little bit out there. So, and what's wrong with being like great? What's wrong with having great happiness or joyful excitement, right? I mean, who wouldn't want to feel like complete ecstasy all the time? And I'm not talking about the pill either, but just being overly just happy and excited, like that type of energy, I'm telling you, it could really go and just change the whole world. And next, we're going to talk about eliminate seriousness. Now, eliminate seriousness is two words, but really, guys, don't take things too seriously. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're, as you're learning this stuff, like, if this is something that you want to be in for the long haul, don't worry about, like, trying to get things right on the first go around. Oh, now, maybe you might need to watch this video a few times just to really, like, understand everything that's being said here. Because, like I said, there's a lot of information that's being shared, but don't beat yourself up too much about like learning this stuff. Like, just take your time, enjoy it, have fun, because there's a lot to learn. It's gonna be great, you know what I mean? Like, for me, like, I was a little bit intimidated at first when I started learning all this stuff, but as I just began to take my time and really just kind of allow everything to digest and to sink in, I began to realize just how rich and powerful this field is. So if you're feeling serious right now, if you're like, feel like this is serious business, just take it relax, like take a chill pill for a second, because it's all good. You're going to learn this all in time. You're in the right place. And this is a very comprehensive presentation on NLP, if I do say so myself. All right. So the four I's, I promise you, this is it. I know we just did the 12 C's and the 12 V's, but these four I's, after the four I's, we're done with gratitude. Okay. I promise. So four I's. We're going to talk about integrity first. Now, integrity is a quality of being honest and having strong moral principles. Now, integrity is something you don't see really a lot of these days. Like, it seems like everybody's just trying to, you know, trying to get an edge, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? Like, do something that they really shouldn't be doing or anything like that, or try to do things behind other people's back. Now, when it comes to NLP, like, this is some really powerful stuff right here, if I do say so myself. So it's very important that you have a certain level of integrity. Like, when you're working with people, that you want to be able to, you want to be focused on helping people for the better. You don't want to be trying to like game other people and stuff, because if you believe in karma or anything like that, like, that stuff will come back to haunt you, and it won't be good for you. It won't be good for the other person. It's not going to be good for the world. So always act with integrity. Just do the right thing. Even if no one's watching, even if no one will acknowledge you for doing the right thing, it's going to go a long way towards just being a good person and towards just making the world and overall a better place. Next, we have integration. Integration is bringing separate things together in a cohesive unity. Now, when it comes to integration, really for the purposes of NLP, there's going to be things that you're going to be learning, like over in the book, and there's also going to be things that you're going to need to experience. And to really understand NLP and to use it effectively, you want to combine the things that you learn in your head and also the things that you experience and bring them together, because once you begin to integrate knowledge from that level, now you really begin to get a feel and understand for what NLP is about, because there's two sides to it. There's a learning part, there's a doing part, and you really need both parts if you want to understand NLP and use it in a way that helps other people in a very profound way. Last, we have intentionality, which is pretty much just the fact of being deliberate. Like I said before, there's a lot of people that kind of go around in life like kind of like half asleep, like there's some kind of zombie or something like that. So you don't want that to be you, especially when it comes to neurolinguistic programming. You want to have a very clear idea of where it is that you're trying to go, because once you're clear on that, you can tell whether or not you're getting closer to where you're going or not, and you can make the necessary adjustments. So always act from attention, have a strong level of attention in anything that you do, not just in neurolinguistic programming, but in life as well. It will take you very, very far. All right. So now we're done with the NLP attitude. So now we're going to talk about the presuppositions. But before I jump to the presuppositions, I just want to give you a little bit of background information on what it's about. Now, if you decide to do your NLP training, now everybody kind of has like their own different interpretation on what the NLP presuppositions is about and stuff. And there really isn't one correct set of presuppositions. This is just some presuppositions that I found that more or less encapsulated what NLP was about. Now, these things are neither true nor not true. These are just very useful beliefs and or filters to have as far as just going out and being out there in the world and stuff. So that's pretty much what these presuppositions is about. All right, so with that being said, the first presupposition is the meaning of the communication is the response that you get. So what does that mean for us? So Everybody out there is like constantly communicating and stuff, right? Like we communicate verbally, we communicate non-verbally. We all want to go and transmit information. At least that's the idea behind it, right? We want to transmit information to other people. Now, let's say there's a certain message that you want to present to another person, and you go and you communicate to that person, and that person responds in a way that you don't expect, or in a way that you don't expect. Let's leave it at that. You respond in a way that you don't respect. So, what are you to do? Are you to do the same thing that you did before, or are you going to try something else? Now, if you pick B, try something else, then congratulations. You win absolutely nothing. But anyways, on a more serious note, if you're communicating to someone and they're responding in a way that you're not expecting, or which is not what you're looking for per se, then it means that whatever you try to communicate was not being communicated. The response to how to communicate it is what you actually communicated. So it's up to you to be able to vary your response, to vary your behaviors in such a way such that the person that received the communication responds in the way that you expect them to respond. So I know that was a bit of a mouthful. You might need to rewind that just to watch that again. But that's pretty much what it is. Don't worry so much about you communicating the information over. Worry about how the person is responding to the communication that you're presenting to them. Secondly, the map is not the territory. And now the corollary, the menu is not the meal either. So pretty much what that means is that we all have these mental maps that we all kind of like use to orient ourselves in the world, right? Like, these are obviously conceptual in nature. We don't literally have maps unless you like live in the 90s or the 80s, whatever. I guess when they're using road maps and whatnot, which is, I don't know, that was a crazy time. But anyways, excuse me. A map, for our purposes, we're using it more in the perceptual sense. So we all have like these maps that we use to like kind of help us navigate the reality. And I know it may seem like we kind of navigate the reality like, oh, what do you mean, Jacob? I mean, what do you mean, James? Like we're in the real world and stuff. And not necessarily. What we really experience is just our preconception of the world. What we call a model of the world, so to speak. And this model of the world is subject to be changed. Now, the real world, for as far as we know, the real world can't be changed. But we can change our map of the world. We can change our model of the world, which we use to like kind of interact in the world, to be in the world, so to speak. So you have to be open to changing your map, especially on when you receive new data that doesn't correspond with the map. There may be times you may just need to change parts of the map or just change the map entirely. So never get too caught up in your preconception of the world. Be willing and be open to changing it, because obviously we're not going to get it right in the first time. We're human beings, we're limited in our conception and our perception and stuff. So be open to change. Next, language is a secondary representation of experience. Now, language is a very high level function. As far as we're concerned, we're the only animals on this planet that can utilize language to the degree that we have. But language is not experience. We just use language as a way to package experience in a way where we can communicate it to other people. You see what I'm saying? So this is just an important distinction to keep in mind, more so than anything else, because a lot of times we kind of get caught up in the language and in the way that we say things and stuff, that we think the words that we say are real than the things that it is trying to describe. So always keep that in mind, that language is nothing more than a representation of experience. And a secondary representation is that. Next, mind and body are part of the same cybernetic system which affect each other. Now, cybernetic is pretty much a self-regulated system, and that's pretty much how the mind and body act. The mind and body are pretty much just two parts of the same thing, or just two parts of the same whole. So whatever happens with the mind affects with the body, and pretty much whatever happens with the body affects the mind. So if you can control your mind, you're able to control your body, and so on and so forth. So that's pretty much all I got to say about that. I kind of break it down a little bit more in the blog post. If you want to check out the blog post, link is in the description down below. But anyways, moving forward, law of requisite variety. Now, in any cybernetic system, just like the mind and body system, the element or the person with the widest range of behaviors, variability, or choice will control the system. So essentially what that means is that let's say you're in an interaction, right? Like, let's say it's you and it's one other person, and both of you guys are kind of like communicating with each other. So whichever one of you has the widest range of behaviors, variability, or choice, or just the greatest range of responses, will control that interaction. So It's important as an NLP that you always want to maintain a high degree of flexibility in how you speak and how you carry yourself, because as long as you're maintaining a high degree of flexibility, you're always going to be in control of that situation. Once you start to have low degree of like behavioral flexibility of just being able to interact and be in the world, then you can best believe that the person that you're with that has a great degree of flexibility will be in control of that situation, whether you want them to or to not. So something just to be very aware of. Next is that behavior is geared towards adaptation. That's now this is a bit of a technical point that we're talking about here as far as like adaptation and stuff. Hold on, I'm gonna look something up real quick that kind of breaks this down pretty well. Okay, so. Alright, so when I say behavior is geared towards adaptation, pretty much one's behavior is determined by the context in which that behavior originates, and one's reality is defined by one's perceptions of the world. Now, the behavior that one exhibits is appropriate to the reality, and all of one's behavior, whether good or bad, is an adaptation. And I just wanted to read that to you real quick because this really helps to kind of drive the point home as far as adaptation and stuff. Now, like I was saying before, we all kind of live in our own model of the world. Like in essence, we all live in a different world from everyone else if we're referring to the model, which is what we actually correspond with, and not the actual external world. Now, according to that model of the world that we each conform to, we create behaviors within that model of the world that's appropriate to the reality that we supposedly live in and stuff. So it's just something to keep in mind. Like, we see like a person behavior and it may seem a bit strange to us, but in that person's model of the world, it makes perfect sense for them to be acting like that. Next, present behavior represents the best choice available to that person. Now, under every behavior that a person has lies a positive intent. So pretty much what that means is, like, if you take a person, right, like you take anybody and you take into account who that person is, all the life experiences, all the choices that they're aware of, they make the best choice that's available to them at any moment in time. And if they're given a better choice, they will take it. So pretty much the key here in neurolinguistic programming is that we want to help give people much more empowering choices, just like how we mentioned in attitude that choice is one of the C's. As far as like having a proper attitude, we want to make sure that we're giving people more choices and hopefully better choices to choose from, so that way they're not stuck with doing the things that they've been doing that's been getting them the results that they've been getting. Next, behavior is to be evaluated and appreciated or changed as appropriate in the context presented. So pretty much what that means is that we need to evaluate other people's behavior in terms of what they are capable of becoming, and we need to help people strive to become all that they can be. So when it comes to behaviors, like behaviors is something that's some universal in a sense. And when I mean universal, it means that behaviors are only appropriate to the context presented. So for example, right? Now it may be appropriate, like let's say if you had a basketball game, to like maybe wear a face paint and to be yelling and screaming and just be acting one way, but you probably want to act in a basketball game the same way you would act in, say, a church that's having mass or service. You see, those are two different contexts, and one behavior isn't going to be appropriate in the other context. You see what I'm saying? So that's how we got to evaluate behavior. We have to look at the context that this behavior is being presented in and study it, change it if necessary, or just appreciate it for what it is. Next, people have all the resources they need to make the changes they want. Now, I know this is a very bold statement to make, but this is something that I very much believe in and something that I hope that you believe in as well. You see, people already are incredible beings. Like, people have no idea how powerful they are, how capable they are capable of becoming. But it's up to us as neurolinguistic practitioners to help people become more aware of the resources that they have and help connect them to those resources, so that way they can go out there and create the changes that they want to create. And you see what I'm saying? Next, possible in the world and possible for me is only a matter of how. Now, this is actually something I got from Wyatt Woodsmall. He's actually another very prominent master trainer of neurolinguistic programming. And this is pretty much what forms the basis for modeling. And for those of you that aren't familiar with modeling, it's pretty much just taking taking a skill that someone is good at and just breaking it down to its necessary components. You see what I'm saying? So if you see something happening in the world, it doesn't matter what skill it is. Maybe this person is really good at selling. Maybe they're really good at playing video games, or they're really good at like public speaking. If it's possible in the world, then that means it's very possible that you can do it as well, in theory. Now obviously, there may be like greater, there may be some training and some preparation involved, but if it's possible in the world, that means it's possible for you. And really, all we have to do is just figure out how it's being done, so that way we can go out there and replicate it. Very, very powerful stuff. Next, the highest quality information about other people is behavioral. Now, why do I say that? Now, you see, now people are going to say a lot of stuff. Like, people are really good at talking. I think I'm pretty good at talking. But people love to talk a lot. And we do take into account what people say and stuff. Because obviously, if we did take into account what people say or give any weight to what people said at all, then, you know, we would just live in a world where people just didn't trust each other and we would probably go all extinct. But we do take into account what people say to some extent, but the behaviors, the thing that we can see, that's going to always trump whatever that they say. Because they may be saying one thing, but if their behaviors is showing something else, then we need to be focusing on the behaviors that they're showing at that present time. Next, it is useful to make a distinction between behavior and self. And this kind of builds on the point that I was talking about before. Because yes, behavior is the highest quality information that we can get about other people. But at the same time, people are not their behaviors. Like, who you, like what you're doing at any moment is not going to even come close to who you are. Like, your actual self, like the I or the you, so to speak, that's always going to be much, much greater than any like single behavior that you're doing at any time. So if somebody's doing a behavior that's causing them harm and stuff, that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with their self, so to say. It just means that the behavior is wrong. So all we need to do is focus on changing that behavior, not necessarily the self. The self and the behavior are two entirely different things. Our behaviors constantly are changing, but the self always remains the same. Very important thing to keep in mind. And last but not least, there's no such thing as failure. There's only feedback. Now, this is something, now this is a presupposition that I really love, because not to say that failure like doesn't exist entirely. Like, obviously we should acknowledge some things as failures, at least in certain instances, but feedback is pretty much just another way of saying that, all right, I did something, I got back some information. Now, what am I going to do with this information? In fact, Thomas Edison is probably the perfect example of this. Now, you may have heard the story of Thomas Edison where he was asked, like, oh, like, you fail at, like, creating the light bulb, like, 10,000 times, right? Like, we all hear about Thomas Edison trying 10,000 times to create a light bulb and then not work for some reason. But what he said in response to that was just completely genius, in my opinion. He said, oh, I didn't fail 10,000 times, is what he said. I merely just found 10,000 ways that did not work. And you see how that, like, that subtle shift is so, can be so powerful just by acknowledging, like, okay, it's not so much out of eyes. If you notice something isn't working, then acknowledge that it's not working, but be willing to do something else and to do something different. And you do that by just determining the feedback and being able to adjust and calibrate based off the feedback that you're getting at that moment in time. Very powerful stuff. All right, so next. Now, we just finished covering the NLP presuppositions, so now we're going to talk about the four operational principles behind neuro-linguistic programming, which is really going to help you make this thing work for you. Now, the first operational principle behind neuro-linguistic programming is, so one is that you want to know your outcome. So what do I mean by that? Is that essentially you want to know what it is that you're going after at the end of the day. Like, if you're not clear on what the end result is, then anything that you're doing is pretty much more or less pointless, because you're just doing things and you don't really have a clear idea in mind of where it is that you want to go. So you want to know your outcome, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more when we start talking about how to create a well-formed outcome. Next, after you know your outcome, like you know what it is that you're going for, you want to have sufficient sensory acuity to know whether or not you're getting closer to it. Now, sensory acuity pretty much just obviously responds to the senses, like what it is that you can see, what you can hear, what you can touch, so on and so forth. You want to have very good sensory acuity to know whether or not you're getting closer, because without the sensory acuity to know whether or not you're getting closer, then you're just going to keep doing things and you might get a little bit closer or you might get a lot farther. And chances are you're probably going to get a lot farther from your goal because you're not having the sensory acuity to know that you're getting closer or farther away from it. Next, after you have sufficient sensory acuity to know whether or not you're getting closer, you want to have sufficient flexibility of behavior so that you can vary your behavior until you get your outcome. Now, pretty much what that means is, like, obviously, it's one thing to be able to notice that you're getting further away, but now, after that, you have to be able to do things differently so that way when you're going, so that way you can do the necessary different actions so you can get closer to your outcome instead of getting away from it. And last but not least is that you want to take action now. Take action now. In fact, I had to say that twice because it's that important. We keep thinking that we can act in the future or act someday, but the only time that we can act is right here and right now. So if you've been sitting your butt telling yourself that, yo, I'm going to do something one day or someday, that day is today. Take action. Make it happen. Okay, so we talked about knowing your outcomes, but now we're going to dive much deeper into that concept about how to create a well-formed outcome. Now, to create a well-formed outcome requires a couple of steps, as you can see. Firstly, is that it must be stated in positive terms. This is very important because a lot of people, like, you'll ask them, like, hey, like, what do you want? And they might say something like, oh, well, I don't want to be fat anymore, or I don't want to be broke, or I don't want to live with my parents, or anything like that. You see, we cannot have a negation of experience. A negation of experience is impossible. We can only have a positive experience in a sense. So if you say that, oh, I don't want to be fat anymore, then your goal should be, oh, I want to lose 20 pounds. You see, that's a positive goal. That's something that can be measured. That makes sense. Or if you say, like, oh, I don't want to live with my parents anymore, you can say, well, I want to move into a 2-bedroom apartment. You see, just simple things like that can create dramatic differences in results. Now, next is that your outcome must be testable and demonstrable in sensory experience. So what does that mean exactly? It means that I should be able to take out a movie camera and be able to film what your final outcome looks like. So if I can't take out a movie camera and film your final outcome, then that means that it's not testable or demonstrable in sensory experience. excuse me. Next is that it must be sensory specific, which pretty much just builds on the point before about having sensory experience, that you want to be able to describe your outcome in ways that are, that you can see it, you can hear it, you can feel it, you can touch it. I mean, maybe you can even taste it if you're into that, but it must be sensory specific. It must engage the senses. Next, it must be initiated and maintained by the subject. Now, this is an outcome that you're setting for yourself. Obviously, the subject would be you, but when it comes to, like, creating an outcome, you want to make sure that the control over this outcome is completely maintained by you, or if you work with someone, is completely initiated and maintained by the subject, meaning that they must be in complete control of this outcome, or whether or not they're able to get it or not able to get it. It shouldn't be, in other words, it shouldn't be required that someone else needs to change or someone else needs to do something in order to attain the outcome. Now, you could be willing to do something in order to, like, inspire another person to change, but ultimately, when it comes to, like, getting an outcome that you want, it must rely solely on you, or if you work with a client, it must rely solely on them for them to achieve it. Next, your well-formed outcome must be appropriately and explicitly contextualized. Now, we talked a bit about context before in the previous slides, but this really just kind of helps to drive the point home. Like I said, like, behaviors only make sense in certain contexts. Like, if you want to create a change within someone and they want to be able to exhibit a certain behavior or just achieve a certain outcome, there has to be a specific context that they want to achieve this behavior or outcome. Now, when you start creating universals, now this starts messing with the ecology, which is something that we talked about earlier. Now, this could potentially affect this person, or it could affect the people around them in negative ways. Next, it should preserve any positive product of the present state. So pretty much, like, yeah, we all want to go, and we want to go after outcomes that's supposedly going to give us a better life and just make things happier and richer and all that good stuff. But there's still things within our presidency that's positive, and it's important that as we're going and we're chasing our outcomes, that we retain the positive, that we retain anything positive that's going on in our environment. So let's say, like, if you're really broke right now, right, and you want to get rich, but one of the positive products of your present state is that you already work out a lot. Now, you don't want to be chasing riches to the point that you end up letting your health go to waste. You see, that's not preserving that your health. And what happens is, as you go and you achieve your outcome, like, the more successful you become, the worse your health becomes, and then you just end up with even bigger problems that you had before. Which brings us to our last point, is that it must be ecologically sound. That means whatever that you're going after, it has to be good for you. It has to be good for the people around you. It has to be good for the environment. All these factors have to remain in balance even after you achieve your outcome. So that's well-formed outcome, guys. So now we just finished talking about the well-formed outcome. Now we're going to get into the NLP communication model. And I know this looks like a freaking masterpiece, doesn't it? I know. I did it myself. But I know we got a lot going on here, but I'm gonna try to break this down piece by piece to you, just so you can kind of understand what's going on here. So according to the NLP communication model, right? So over here we have the external event that's happening. Now, external event could be anything. It could be like a baseball game that's happening. It could be like a date. It could be anything that's happening in the external world that could be described in visual, auditory, kinesthetic, olfactory, so on and so forth. That's pretty much what the external event represents. So from the external event, these events go through our filters. And our filters, pretty much what you do is that they delete, distort, and generalize. Now, we use delete, distort, and generalization in a very particular way. Now, delete means that we actually omit certain parts of our experiences out. Distort means that we misrepresent certain aspects of our experiences. Now, a great example of this distortion is, imagine that you're walking in a forest, right? And you, at the corner of your eye, you think that you see like some kind of rattlesnake or something. So, you know, your heart starts racing, like your palms get sweaty, you feel the sweat dripping down your forehead, you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, this snake is gonna bite me or whatever, right? But then you go and you turn around, and all of a sudden, instead of it being a snake, it's just like a piece of rope on the ground, right? So you see, that's an example of distortion. You thought that you saw one thing, but your brain, in a sense, misrepresented that experience and told you that it saw something else entirely. And generalize is pretty much just to draw global conclusions based on two or three different outcomes. So generalizing is, for example, like with doors. Let's take doors, for example, right? You see, now we don't have to, now for most of us, we don't have to like relearn the concept of like what a door is and stuff, right? Like if you go and you see a door, like you see it like it's some like kind of rectangular feature that got a little knob and stuff. Like you know like what a door is when you see one. And you probably only had to see a door a few times to kind of just have an idea of what a door is. Even if it's a little bit different, it might be a different color, but that's how we use generalization, and that's how generalizing can be very useful, but sometimes it can be very unuseful. So these are the six filters that we use to delete, distort, and generalize reality. So from there, it finally hits over to us, and then we create an actual internal representation. And our internal representation influences our state. Our state influences our physiology, and our state also is what creates our behavior. So all these things are connected with one another, and the unconscious and conscious here. Now metaprograms, now from here on out, this goes from conscious all the way to more conscious, but really unconscious could be kind of like can flow between metaprograms and memories. But we're gonna break down the filters in a little bit more. Alright, so next we're going to talk about internal processes and filters. Now, internal processes and filters is pretty much how we delete, distort, and generalize information to our five senses, as we were talking about earlier. So the first filter we're going to be talking about is the metaprogram filter. Now, the metaprogram filter is probably the deepest level filter of the five, and the one that we're the most unconscious of. According to Hall and Bodenhammer, the internal, the metaprograms is pretty much a sorting device or pattern that we use perceiving, paying attention to information, and inputting and processing the stimuli around us. So these are metaprograms. They don't hold content in themselves per se, but what they use is they use to organize content, and they play a large role in how we perceive the content that we're that we're looking at. So Metapogram is really its own beast in itself, and I'll probably be doing a video later on the different Metaprograms itself. So if it doesn't quite make too much sense now, don't worry about it. But I just wanted to expose you to at least to the idea. Now, after metaprograms is values, and values is pretty much how we decide our actions are good or bad, right or wrong, or just provide the primary motivating force behind our actions. Now, values is something that's very important. Now, a lot of the time, our values are shaped by our parents, by our school system, by our religion and stuff. So, a lot of times, these values aren't choose consciously per se. They usually choose by the people around us, and usually largely determined by our environment. But these can be very powerful filters, so to speak, that can allow us to see certain things but block us off from seeing other things. It's like how you can go and like leave your country, so to speak, and let's say you live in the United States and you go and you visit Canada or something like that. You notice that the values are very different, and you're not going to be as aware of it if you just stay in your own environment. So values are something that's very fluid and can change depending on the environment, depending upon the time, depending on so many different factors. So after values, okay, let me get this presentation working. So at the value of this, is beliefs. So beliefs is pretty much our convictions or acceptance that certain things are true or real. Yes, I did spell certain wrong. Please don't hate me. So beliefs are very powerful because we tend to treat beliefs as if it's something that's absolutely 100% true. And what do I mean by that? Right now, as I'm recording this video, I have like this bottle of water that's kind of on my right hand side. And I know that this bottle of water is here. Like, I can clearly see it. I can touch it. I can hold it. I can even take a sip of it if I want to. And what's interesting is that our beliefs kind of have that same level of truthiness, you could say, to them, where we kind of take them as something that's absolutely true and real, and we don't really stop to question it. I take like a religious belief, for example. Like, some people are very religious, whether you're a Christian or Protestant, Buddhism, Hinduism, whatever. We take our religion and usually what comes with it as being absolutely true, whether we believe in there's a divine creator, or maybe you don't believe in a divine creator at all. But beliefs, or say, like, take the belief like you believe that the sun's going to come up tomorrow. Now, that may not necessarily be true. The sun may not come up tomorrow, but we treat that belief as being true. So beliefs can be very powerful, and just making small shifts in our beliefs can have very massive results. Now, after beliefs, we have attitudes. Now, attitudes builds upon the beliefs and values in the sense that the collections of values and beliefs around a certain subject. Now, changing a value is one thing, and changing a belief is something else, but changing an attitude is really like a whole beast unto itself. And what I mean by that is that pretty much our attitudes are very hard to change because, like I said, it's a collection of values and beliefs. And so it's usually in regards to like multiple values and beliefs around something. So it can be very challenging to change, but of course it's not impossible, especially when you have the technology like neurolinguistic programming. Next is we have memories. And memories is pretty much just the ability to recall past information or past experiences. Now, some people say that memories is ultimately what makes us who we are, because our memories is just, because without our memories, let's say if you didn't have any memories at all, you have no idea like where you were raised, like what kind of information you've been exposed to, or you know, any like of those formative events that may have contributed to who you are right now. Like, we only are able to have some sense of who we are, that some sense of duration in this life, by being able to access the memories that we have from the past. So memories are very powerful and play a huge role in filtering how we perceive our reality. And last but not least is our decisions. Decisions is pretty straightforward, just a choice that is made, or really it's just an act of making up your mind when deciding between several different possible choices. Now, when we were younger, we were making decisions and we may have not necessarily been aware of them. Like, maybe we had a really strong authoritative parent that it would tell us that, being fat is like a sin or something like that. Let's say that was like implanted into you. Now, you may decide that being fat is something that's bad because, you know, that was imprinted into you at such a young age. Like, it was a decision that was made. It's just a decision that you really was in a position to like critically examine or to study. So you just kind of went along with whatever decision was impressed upon you around that time. So we're constantly making decisions every day. Like, hopefully now, if as an adult, we should have a greater degree of control over the decisions that we make. But more often than not, the decisions that we make are nothing more than reflections that we have made in the past. So always realize that these decisions are constantly filtering your experience, and these decisions are going to affect what you remember, your attitude, your beliefs, your values, and so on and so forth. So decisions are very important, and it's the first step towards actually creating change by deciding. So let's talk about a little bit about the representation systems, because this is something you're going to see come up time and time again, especially in regards to neuro-linguistic programming. So as far as the representation system goes, there's really five that we really primarily focus on. And out of those five, there's only three of those that we focus on. So the five representations are the visual representation, obviously, which refers to our seeing; auditory, which refers to hearing; kinesthetic, which refers to feeling; olfactory, which is the things that we smell; and last but not least, gustatory, which refers to taste. Now, when it comes to working with representation system, when it comes to the different patterns and stuff, which we're going to be talking about in a little bit, but usually when it comes to working with the different patterns, usually the representation system we normally access is a visual, the auditory, and the kinesthetic. Olfactory and gustatory, they're not really practical to be using, but they are very powerful. Not to say that they're not powerful, but they're not very practical. Like, to remember a certain smell or a certain taste, it can get a little fuzzy at times. But for visual, auditory, and kinesthetic, it tends to be a lot easier to work with, and usually these are the three, one of the three primary representation systems that people fall under. So we can usually work with those and create some pretty powerful changes using these representation systems. Next is I-axis and cues. Now this builds off the whole representation system, which is pretty much nothing more than just unconscious eye movements that just indicate the use of particular representational systems, which we already learned about previously. So the picture that you see in front of you here, now this is for someone that's right-handed. For a person that is left-handed, theirs is going to be pretty much the mirror image of this. Now there's going to be some people that you're going to be working with that don't fall under either category. They don't fall under this category, or they use a mirror image. But whatever they do use, they're going to use it very consistently. So let's say, for example, you have someone that's a bit abnormal, right? And the constructed auditory, instead of being towards the left here, as we see on this diagram, is down here. If that's the case, then that's always going to be the case for that person. So axes and cues tend to be very consistent. So they tend to be a very pretty they're pretty reliable way to understand the type of representation system that our person is using. Now, next, we're going to talk about the NLP patterns. Now, what are the NLP patterns, right? Now, a lot of people, when they think about neurolinguistic programming, they think about the patterns, but they really just make up a small part of what neurolinguistic programming is. But it would be a huge mistake to leave it out, so we're going to finally talk about it, especially after all the groundwork that we laid up to this point. So NLP patterns are pretty much nothing more than just structured processes that are used to create the change unwanted behaviors and create rapid change. It pretty much empower people to run their own brains and construct subjective realities that enhance how they function. Now, what do we mean by all that stuff, right? Now, we've talked about running our own brain before, and that's really where the heart of NLP lies, among other things, of course, but to help people with running their own brain, because our brain is such a powerful, it's kind of like one of the most powerful supercomputers ever. And the thing is, when we were born into this world, we wasn't really like given like a manual or given instructions on how to use our brain. But with NLP, we actually start to pull back the curtains a bit and understand exactly like how our brain, or more specifically our mind, works, and how we can utilize our mind to help us create the subjective realities that we want. Because like I said already, we all live in our own model of the world. Like, my model world is not going to be the same as yours, and yours isn't going to be the same as your friends, and so on and so forth. But we can go and, understanding that all models are pretty much subjective, we can go and take those subjective realities and create a reality that's empowering to us, that helps us to create the life that we want. And not only can we do that for ourselves, but we can do that for other people. Now, there's a lot of different NLP patterns that exist out there, and there's constantly more that are being created, but these are the four main categories when it comes to the patterns. Now, the four types of patterns is the first one is a parse pattern. Parse patterns are pretty much used to integrate two or more parsers in conflict. So what do we mean when we say parse and sub? Now, have you ever had the experience where it's like you had one inclination to do something? Like, let's say part of you really wanted to go to the gym and really work out and stuff, but another part of you just wanted to kind of like sit down and just veg out in front of the TV. That's pretty much an example of like what a part is. It's kind of like a sub-personality because it's obviously, it's not like a full-blown personality, but it's a sub-personality that it has certain like inclinations, it has certain like drives and desires and stuff that you feel on the inside, and at times like you may have another feeling on the inside that may be in complete conflict with the other one. So with these parse patterns, it allows to integrate these two conflicting patterns together, so that way you can go out and you know, no longer have like that inner source of conflict anymore. Next is the identity patterns. Identity patterns are pretty much patterns that relieve the stress inherent in one's sense of self. So your sense of self is very important. I probably don't need to tell you that, but it's very important that you have a very, you should have a very firm grasp on what your sense of self is. And once that sense of self starts to be deteriorated, like maybe you're not feeling like, as confident in yourself as you should be, or maybe you feel like you just never get anything right, or you're just really hard on yourself in general, it could be a problem with your identity. So this helps to relieve that distress and helps you feel better with your sense of self and being able to become more effective in living out in the world. So next is the stasis pattern. Stasis patterns are pretty much patterns that correct problematic, unresourceful states of consciousness. So what do I mean by an unresourceful state? Now, have you ever had the experience where you like you woke up the morning and you just felt like you woke up on the wrong side of bed? Just felt like nothing was gonna go right. You just kind of went through the day. You kind of just really felt down and dumped yourself. You know, your girlfriend left you, or maybe you got late for work, or you got a verbal or something like that. Then you just found yourself like being in like this negative like cycle, so to speak. Right? You just feel like you can't really like lift your head like above the seawater, so to speak. You know what I mean? So that's what happens. Like us as human beings, we get into these negative states. Like getting into a negative state is normal, but if you're in a negative state like all the time, or it just tends to persist a lot longer than it should, then these patterns can help to correct that, so that way you can have easier access in the positive states, or if anything, be in a positive state much more often. And next is we have the language patterns. Now, the language patterns are pretty much patterns that correct cognitive errors and self-talk and languaging oneself in negative ways. Now, language, now a lot of people underestimate the power of language, but there is that quote that goes that the pen is mightier than the sword. And there really is a lot of truth to that, because the way that we talk about ourselves, the way that we talk about our experiences, really says a lot about how we feel and how we interact in the world itself. And if you're the type of person where like you're constantly languaging and you're constantly using like negative language and stuff, or you're constantly just using language that disempowers you, then you need to, then these patterns right here could really help you in correcting those language and being able to language yourself in a positive way and correct any kind of errors that you may be having in your self-talk, so that way you become more empowered and a much more powerful individual. So next we have the thinking styles patterns. Thinking styles patterns pretty much correct cognitive perceptual distortions or inappropriate metaprograms. So we talked a little bit about the metaprograms before, and these patterns right here really do a great job as correcting metaprograms. Like you may, now I didn't touch too much on metaprograms, but as you could tell, as we already discussed earlier, metaprograms lie at the deepest level of our mind. And when we have problems with our metaprograms, then they can really create greater problems throughout our values, our belief systems, and so on and so forth. Next is the meaning pattern. Meaning patterns are patterns that correct limiting beliefs and unenhancing meanings. Now, our beliefs are very powerful. They pretty much determine like how far we can go, or what we can or what we cannot do. So a lot of times people get caught up in these limiting beliefs and don't even realize it. So thanks to these patterns, you can hold and you can correct those limiting beliefs and create meanings that enhance you to become a more powerful individual. And next we have the strategies patterns, the last but not least. And pretty much these strategy patterns are patterns that help to give rise to a piece of desired behavior, because obviously, like we said earlier, behavior is pretty much the most reliable form of information you can get from a person. So when you're able to imitate behavior, or when you're able to like create new behaviors within yourself, you're able to, in essence, create a new life for yourself, because it's only by exhibiting new behaviors that were able to create changes in the world. We can't create changes in the world just by thinking about it or hoping for it. We have to have the behaviors that correspond to the changes that we want to create. And next, now we finished talking about patterns, but I want to talk about anchoring, which is also a really important technique in neurolinguistic programming. Now, anchoring is pretty much just a process of association, associating an internal response with an external trigger. So what do we mean by all that stuff? So how many of you are if you're familiar with the Pavlov's dog experiment, pretty much the way that experiment worked is that whenever Pavlov would go and he would bring food out to the dogs would start salivating. And while they were salivating and he had the food out himself, he would go and he would ring a bell. So what would happen is he would do this experiment several times. Like every time he brought the food out, he would ring the bell, the dogs start salivating. So what he did after he did this a couple of times is that he would go and he would just ring the bell, right? He just rang the bell. He didn't bring any food out. But what happened, which was really interesting, is that the dog started salivating. They pretty much responded to the bell, as if there was food that was coming out, but there was no food coming out. It was just a bell. So that's pretty much what an anchor is. The anchor, so in this instance, the external trigger would be the bell that's ringing, and the internal response would be the dogs that are salivating. Now, for us humans, now, we could do a lot more cooler stuff than just salivating when we hear a bell ring. We can be much more concise and have a lot more play when it comes to creating these types of anchors. For example, we have stacking anchors, which is where you're able to associate a series of events with one anchor to strengthen the intensity of a subject's response to a specific anchor. So for example, right, let's say you set an anchor on someone's like knuckle and stuff, and you have them anchor like very happy and positive moments. Like you have them think of one moment, you touch that same spot over and over again. So what happens is you go and you keep on stacking different like happy moments. You ask them to think of a time when they felt really powerful, and you keep touching the same place on that person. And what happens is that whenever they go and they fire that anchor off, because of all the different events and associations that they have packed into it, it becomes a much more stronger and a much more powerful anchor. Next, we have collapsing anchors, which pretty much you neutralize negative, but it's a process of neutralizing negative states by triggering two incompatible responses at the same time. So collapsing anchors is pretty much you create an anchor for the negative state, and then you take an anchor for a positive state, and you anchor them in two different places, and you fire them off at the same time, and it pretty much just goes and it neutralizes the negative state. Next is chaining anchors, which is a bit more advanced technique, which pretty much is where you take where you create a series of anchors to lead from an undesired state through a series of intermediary states to the desired state. So let's say the undesired state, let's pick an undesired state to have. An undesirable state could be something like, depression. You can go and you could create a series of anchors that can take them to from depression, because it go from depression to like ecstasy, let's say. That's a really huge jump to make. So with chaining anchors, you're able to go from depression, and then you go one level up and another level up until you're able to get to like complete ecstasy, where they're just happy, they're just bouncing off the wall happy and stuff. But it allows people to have some sort of a progression, so that way they're not jumping from like one negative state to another positive state, because that could be very challenging for a lot of people. All right, so next we're going to talk about perceptual positions. Now, perceptual positions is pretty much a technique that's used in NLP. It's to help people to gain like a greater level of perspective on a situation that's happening. So in any situation, there's pretty much three perspectives that we can take at that given time. The first position is obviously our position, which is pretty much how we see, hear, and feel about the situation from our point of view. Second position is the other position. So let's say if you're in an interaction between yourself and another person, pretty much the second position refers to how that other person sees the situation from a perspective that matters to them. And then finally, we have the third position, which is the observer position, which is pretty much how a situation appears to someone who's not involved. So really the key to using perceptual positions is that you want to be using all three positions, because it pretty much each position has its own unique vantage points and its unique advantages and stuff. But what really makes this powerful is when you're able to use all three of them together, so that way you can gain a greater perspective on a situation, looking at it from multiple different angles to help you with solving a problem, dealing with a dispute, or maybe you're having a problem with someone. By utilizing perceptual positions, it allows you really to just take a step back, mentally speaking, and being able to look at it from different angles in a way that's useful and helpful. And next, we're going to talk about logical levels. Now, logical levels is a model that came out much later on after John Grinder and Richard Bandler. It's actually invented by this guy named Robert Dilson Todd Epstein, who actually based their work on Gregory Bateson and Bertrand Russell. So pretty much, logical levels is another really helpful tool for just helping to determine where a problem may lie necessarily, right? Like some for some people, now you let's say you work with someone, right? And they're going through some type of difficulty. Utilize the logical levels to figure out where that difficulty lies. For some people, the difficulty may be like they're responding to their environment inappropriately. Or maybe the difficulty may lie in the fact that they don't possess the necessary skills to do something. Or maybe the difficulty may lie in like they have like some sort of limiting beliefs or values that's preventing them to from achieving the outcome they want. So when it comes to logical levels, it's pretty much just a handy tool to help you kind of figure out where is this person experiencing problems, and so that way you can meet them at the right place to help them solve it. And guys, that's pretty much all that I have here for this presentation. I really hope you guys got a lot of value and that you really understand what neuro-linguistic programming is all about. Now, if you want the mind map to this presentation, all you have to do is go to pciinstitute.net/NLP-mind map, and you'll be able to download an entire mind map on this presentation. Just so you have another visual representation to see like how all the different topics and subtopics connect together, it could be really useful for you. So I definitely recommend you get your hands on this and you download it. And also, just to share this presentation and share this video, because I mean, I really want to help more people understand what neurolinguistic programming about. So if you got value from this video, if you learned something you didn't know before about neurolinguistic programming, make sure that you like and you share this video, share with as many people as you can. And also check out my website over at pciinstitute.net, because I also, that's where I pretty much house all my content information in regards to neurolinguistic programming, entrepreneurship, marketing, all that good stuff. So I really hope you guys got a lot of value out of this. Once again, my name is James Renhouse, founder of PCI Institute. Make sure you hit the subscribe button down below this video, so that way you stay updated on when I release new videos. And I will see you on the next one. Bye for now.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.